Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Can habits for innovation be learned and remembered, like riding a bike can be learned and remembered? Our next guest believes in the innate ability of humans to innovate. Alex Bruton is president of the Innographer and co-founder of the Straight Up Business Institute. He's coming to South Dakota for Launch. That's the 12th annual South Dakota Entrepreneurship Education Conference. The launch kicks off on February 23rd at the McCrory Gardens Education and Visitor Center. That's at 9:30 a.m. Central Time. I caught up with Alex via phone from Calgary. Do you want to begin with just this idea of innovation, and can you define it?
Can I define it? Yeah.
Do we bother? Do we want to define innovation?
But it opens the door, right? Because one of the biggest things with innovation, and I'll start with the word innovation, is that as soon as you say it, everybody has a perception of what it means. And, you know, we hear it all the time, from our press releases to our product, description documents, to our job performance in universities. It's our academic plans. It's everywhere. And it's often accidentally misused and sometimes deliberately abused, just because it's so frequently used, from all those places to the headlines that we read, right? And so the one of the things that I get so passionate about that I do for a living is try to help people get past that, the misunderstandings or not quite understandings, to what it really means to be innovative and build the competencies to do that.
Why do you think it's something that people sort of have misperceptions about? But yet, everybody wants it in some ways. It's like, oh, that's a good thing. It has a positive. We want to be innovative. Yeah. But yet it could even be abused as a term or a phrase or an idea. Tell me why.
Well, there's a few angles on why we want it. I think one of them is the easy answer there is that it is an attractive word. It's an attractive thing to be associated with. It is something that brings in money, for example, or that we inherently know is important. The other angle on it is that it's also human nature to be innovative. It when you look at what it really means, it is absolutely in our DNA to change our environment to increase our well-being, and that at its root is what innovation is all about. And so we've got this kind of, you know, we understand at an instinctive level why it's so important, and intellectually understand what it is, and then we bump into the, okay, but how do I actually do it? Right. We are all on the same page. We've read the same articles. We had the same consultant. We did the same. But now how do we make that happen without falling into the mental ruts that we have about the ways that we normally work, which aren't necessarily all that innovative?
Are we born into sort of, you said it's human nature to be innovative and to change our environment, increase our well-being. So then are we all sort of born with it innately and lose it as we grow up?
Yeah, let's say we all have the potential to be highly innovative, absolutely. And what I guess the argument I'd make is that every 5 to 7 year old has the same competencies in that respect, that they've been encouraged, their whole environment as they grew from baby to 5 to 7 year old has encouraged innovativeness. But then at about that age, and I don't mean to knock on any system, educational or workplace or otherwise, but there is evidence to suggest that at about that age, we start entering into systems, at home, at school, in other places, where you are rewarded for things that aren't necessarily innovative. Your whole environment is no longer around what it really means to foster innovativeness and entrepreneurialism and creativity. And that isn't on its own a bad thing. It's because you need a balance. There are some things you can't teach or do with just those competencies, but if you lose them completely, it can be a real challenge. So when we get to older stages, I mean, for example, I work at a university, and I'll work with students who have achieved getting into that room because they did things that are, you know, that are, the success is measured in ways that are actually at odds with what it means to be innovative. So it's a real kind of challenge for us.
And how do you begin with a university student, for example, or someone who comes to one of your talks to say, you know, there's some things that you need to unlearn, or do you just need to learn new competencies then?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are some things that need to be unlearned. There are some, do you know what the way I talk about it is, it's like a repertoire that we normally pick up a certain tool, and that serves us really well. From you know, it might be a project management tool that we usually, I'm thinking of a company I was in, we usually submit a slide deck to the executive team that says for the next 9 months we're going to be doing this, and that tool serves really well from a project management and control standpoint, but really doesn't serve as well from an innovative standpoint, if you will. And so you've got this challenge of exploiting your resources to do what you already do well, but you also want to explore for new opportunities to create that value and build that well-being, and you need a different tool. So you need different tools in your repertoire. So it's not necessarily unlearning, it's knowing what those other tools are about and how to use them and which to pick up at the right time, if you will.
Okay, sure. So where do you begin in sort of learning these competencies or learning how to innovate again?
Yeah, sure. Well, it starts with, we've talked about tools. It starts with the tools. Give people the tools that they need to so they can pick up the right thing at the right time. And that's a piece of it. The next thing you need, though, is a process. People need to understand what it means to be innovative, what it means to design an innovative solution. And that could be, you know, it could be my 6 and or now 7 and 9 year old children looking at what we call value creation instead of allowance. And it's a shift in process. And with it comes a shift in mindset. But it could also be in an organization where, you know, you may have timesheets that limit you from doing an hour to three of innovative work. So are there barriers in the way? And once you've removed those sometimes simple barriers, often simple barriers, and added things in that encourage and promote the right kind of processes and mindsets, you can make an incredibly big difference. So I think I'm trying to say it's a combination of tools, it's a combination of process and mindset, and then you need to frame the learning environment where it's okay to make mistakes. But if I submitted a plan on the first day of 9 month project, it's okay if it looks nothing like it did only 3 days into the 9 months, because it's okay to learn that what you thought wasn't right, and that it's okay to iterate. It's okay to design in short cycles. It's okay to it's safe to follow the innovation process, because otherwise, I mean, in business, there's that famous saying that, that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And the analogy here is that assessment eats innovation for breakfast. And the idea being, if it's in a classroom and you assess, or you want all these things to happen and you assess with a final exam or a report, a written report, you're going to get learning activities and behaviors that lead to final exams and reports.
Sure.
And the same thing in a workplace. If you assess based on a certain level of performance or no failures, you're not going to get innovativeness. So you also need the right environment where it's safe for innovation to happen.
Right. What are some of those basic tools that people need to be able to choose from?
That's a great question. There's buckets of them, and I'll speak about a couple. One is a whole set of tools around ideation or coming up with ideas. So how do I, you know, normally the classic that you bounce this against is brainstorming. Let's come up with ideas in a brainstorming session. But how do you take someone back to the innate skills we may have had as a kid but may have lost about I call idea storming? How do we go from brainstorming to idea storming? So this, and that's one example of the bucket called ideation or coming up with big ideas. And I do a whole bunch of work around that. That's just one of the things I love the most is things we call them, for example, the idea napkin. Get people back to the literal back of a napkin. even if it's a fairly sophisticated business unit that's already running, let's strip it right down, because you can get three representatives of that business unit into separate rooms and ask them the questions that are on the back of the napkin tool, and you get three different sets of answers, unless that organization's really on what they're trying to do. But the flip side of that is you can design really big ideas. So ideation is one bucket. Opportunity design is another. How do you take that idea that now you've got a process, assume you've got a process, a system, the skills, the mindset, the people, the assessment approaches that support it, and you can come up with ideas. Then how do you take them from there and move them forward so that they can be successful in the context, whether it's social or for-profit or otherwise? Another bucket would be revenue maker. How do you make revenue from that? How do you, you know, what's the income model? What's the structures that support it? What are the legal structures? What's the finance? Well, where do I get the money? And those kind of things. And then separate from all of that, I'll just, as a footnote, mention that I've got people trained and working in this, and they can do it really well. They're up on the big stage. They're writing sophisticated business models, but they sometimes don't know who they are or what they're doing. And that opens this box of competencies or tools that I call the inspired you, knowing who you are and why you're doing what you're doing. And as much as that sounds like a bit of a, you know, airport bookstore self-help section book, this notion of an inspired you, that is sometimes the most powerful thing, because once you help people unlock that, then they are jumping out of bed at 5 a.m. without an alarm clock to come and see you and ask, how do I do these things? And give me those other tools. It's not about the tools anymore. It's about them being a means to the end, you know?
Sure. I think I might read that book if I was in the airport or beyond, though.
Right, sort of, oh, good.
Enough to get...
Well, it's not in there yet, but maybe one day.
Right, not in there yet. So then the processes are those... You know, we're talking about entrepreneurship to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about collaboration. So are we talking about people working together at this point? Is this something that you can work on your own innovation as an entrepreneur and as a solo, you know, operative in your own life, or is all innovation collaborative?
No, it's not all collaborative. You know, don't take that to mean that you can do it without collaborating. But there are points in the process where, for example, we touched on this notion of idea storming. One of the biggest challenges with the stereotypical brainstorming is that you are in a group and that the initial comments anchor the next hour's work. Whereas if you get people to work individually first and bring in the results of that work, it can completely change what happens. The nature of the ideas that come out, the volume of ideas, so that sort of the people's fluency and the quality of ideas can change completely. So that's just one example where you need to balance between collaboration and individual work. And that's where the process and mindsets come in. And also, some people are different. I mean, I run an exercise with people, and I'll explain to them that I actually hate being on the receiving end of this exercise because I'm more introverted.
Right.
But I'd like to take this exercise home for a week, and I'll come back with it being really good. But other people love the in-the-moment timed high-pressure exercise. So it's one of those things where you need that balance of approaches, perspectives, and modes of working.
What kind of ruts do we get into? How do we get stuck?
Organizations are built around optimizing. They're built around, you know, creating value from as much value as possible from a set of resources. So we've got here's our assets, here's our processes, here's what we do, here's our this kind of thing, and so you build systems that help that happen. They may be systems for, you know, I mentioned project management earlier. It may be a system for project management. That allows us to get a project from here to there. Maybe a system for funding those projects. It may be a system for evaluating the performance of the people in those projects and so on. And what that does is it leads to a set of you can call them ruts. I would say, they are. I'll say to people, get out of the ruts we're in. But what we're really saying is, look, that's one part of your repertoire. You know, we need to get also to all these other tools and other parts of the repertoire. And that leads from what might be called sort of a defensive reasoning, which is about, you know, in the corporate context I just described, it's about, am I doing things right? You know, you get your performance evaluated, the project's evaluated, did we do it right? To a more sort of productive reasoning, which is, am I doing the right things? Hmm. And are they the right things for our next steps? And that's a big difference. And so that's sort of what you make me think of in asking that question.
Who's doing innovation really well? When you look around right now, where are you seeing, you know, what is there? Are there industries, or are there corporations, or are there individuals that you look at and you say, yeah, that's what it looks like right there?
I have two answers to that. I think you can look around and you can point to the big organizations, you know, the Apples. And as much heat as Apple takes for not being what it was, it's doing a beautiful job of innovating at its stage of the life cycle. And I think, you know, you have examples like that. You can look at the well-known figures like Elon Musk and what they're doing in their companies, or those companies, to do the things that are happening. And there are some really nice examples like that. And you can point to them, like trying to briefly here. The other answer, though, is today, just think Google, what is it, 16 years old, something like that? We didn't have those tools that short time ago. I mean, they just didn't exist. So what that has done on the flip side is enable so many small, call them organizations, but teams, people and teams that they build around them to innovate really, really well. I got off the phone this morning with a company in Silicon Valley that we're going to partner with on something that I'm doing. And it turns out they're about a four-person team, and they're doing incredible work that's helping organizations across the world, around the world, do it. But they're a four-person team because, and I don't want to say it's because of technology, but it is a suite of tools that we have at our disposal, from being able to communicate, in the moment, in cost-effective ways, to being able to build a website within a day very cheaply. A young person or a nascent entrepreneur can just start in ways they never could before. So that's sort of my, without being as specific about who those people are, there's so many groups like that are innovating, that there's even the threat, and I don't know how far I would take it, but the threat being discussed of that change in the nature of work, the idea of being a corporation may not be as beneficial in some places, because the idea that we go through our career with so many different ways of creating value rather than joining one organization and doing it all there. So these are interesting conversations, but that's kind of where I see it happening.
Sort of some of the hallmarks or fundamentals or tenets, if you will, of innovation. Are they proprietary? Do you sort of keep them to yourself and use them in your own organization? Or is there value in sort of spreading that knowledge and that that literacy around so that everyone is working with the same tools?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's kind of close to my heart, too. I think there's two answers. One is that a corporation or an organization or even a person who invests a lot of time into innovating and learning and developing those processes, there will be a layer of, company-specific and proprietary stuff. Like, I can't tell you, how we get that chip so much smaller than we did. But the tools and processes and ways of learning that help them get to that, I believe very strongly should be open and accessible. I can't argue that it happens. I mean, we live in an economy and a society where it has to happen. But the notion that we compete to help people innovate blows my mind sometimes. To me, it's such a fundamental competency we should give everybody, that you see organizations within one city competing to offer the same services, or you see universities, in the same state or province here in Canada, where you're competing to set up the same things, or you see consultants, charging hundreds of thousands of dollars to run labs, where that learning, the competency building, could be openly accessible. So you're hearing me, I think, lean towards much more towards it. We should that's something everybody should have, and that we all benefit from making that happen. So they can use it in their own proprietary ways, but the how do we do it and how do we help you learn how to do it part should be wide open, in my view.
You can meet award-winning innovation educator Alex Bruton at the 12th Annual South Dakota Entrepreneurship Education Conference. The launch kicks off on February 23rd. It's at the Macquarie Gardens Education and Visitor Center starting at 9:30 a.m. Central Time. Welcome back to In the Moment. Every 2 years, South Dakota teachers, community leaders, and creators are honored for their service in the arts. The 23rd Governor's Awards and Living Indian Treasure Award brought people from all over the state to celebrate on Wednesday. SDPB's China Lockett spoke with three recipients in Pierre.
Nearly 300 people gather in the Capitol for the Arts Awards presentation banquet. Representative Sean Bordeaux introduces the recipient of the Living Indian Treasure Award.
The Dakota Flute Song and of the Art of Flute Carving.
Brian Akipa takes the stage and Bordeaux presents him with a star quilt. Akipa makes traditional Native American flutes.
It kind of started in 1975. I was studying painting under Oscar Howe. And he had a mallard flute in his studio, and I was just so amazed by it. Back then, if you wanted one, you just had to make it. So I studied it, I drew it, I measured it. and I puzzled out how to make it.
Akipa says his work with the flute has been a cultural journey. He writes his own traditional flute music.
I started making my own songs, and I do like the old traditional ones. Maybe there's a song that goes back to the origin of the flute, the very first flute song. So that's one of the first songs I learned. And so that's always been a special song for me. But over the years, I've made my own songs, and I use a traditional format to make the song the same way, so I consider them traditional songs.
He says it's important to specify each song for the performance.
I'll be playing Eagle Dreams, a song I composed after my friend Kevin Locke and I were traveling, and on a high ridge we seen an eagle, and it was snowing. And as we stopped to watch this eagle, it suddenly jumped up and spread its wings. And it looked like it disappeared into the clouds with the snow. And this always made an impression on me. So the song is telling the story of this journey and all the decisions we had to make.
Akipa stands in front of the crowd with a star quilt draped over his left shoulder and begins to play. Governor Dennis Dugard introduces the Governor's Awards. One recipient was Black Hills State Photography Professor Steve Babbitt.
I've said to my students over the years many times, I don't care what you think, I care that you think.
Babbitt was acknowledged for outstanding service in arts education. He says he had many mentors influence him throughout his life. Now he wants to do the same for his students.
And that I get to be, in some small way, a part of that. Helping sometimes, encouraging sometimes, watching success happen, helping students through failure. These are all transformative events that I get to be a part of. I don't think of it as a small thing at all. I think of it as a really important, really honorable thing to do with one's life.
Babbitt started teaching at Black Hills State in 1994. There were two photography classes offered when Babbitt began. He expanded the curriculum to include 13 classes. The school recently started offering a Bachelor's of Fine Arts degree in photography.
South Dakota has an incredible number of dedicated, hardworking, devoted teachers who deserve an award every single day. They're not in it for the money. They do it because they love it.
Babbitt says he is honored to be recognized among so many great teachers.
Our recipient of the Governor's Award for Distinction in Creative Achievement is architect Ward Whitwam, who changed the landscape of South Dakota with innovative designs for schools, churches, elder care facilities, corporate offices, and private residences.
93-year-old Ward Whitwam is originally from Watertown. He joined the Army during World War II, then went to the University of Berkeley, California to study architecture. He says he decided to move home after school.
My college friends couldn't believe, "Ward, you're going back to South Dakota?" I said, "Yes, I am." I said, "I want to open my own office." And I did open my office in 1953, so I'm still practicing 64 years later.
He says he's best known for creating the teepee lodge poles at rest stops across the state.
I think it was President Johnson and his wife. His wife said, "Let's try to show history, the history of the state." And would you believe it, South Dakota was one of the few states that actually did something. And I thought, what better way is to show the lodge poles of the teepees?
Whitwam says he is flattered to receive the same award as other great architects.
I've had a wonderful life with my wife, three wonderful and successful children. At 93 years old, as I move into my twilight years, tears come to my eyes, for I can see in the future, and my grandchildren, and one of my projects saying, "Grandpa did this." Thank you.
Graham and Anna Marie Thatcher, Michael Pangburn, and the Mobridge City Council also received awards for their work in the arts. You can hear the full version of Apica's performance on our website. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Chyna Lockett in Rapid City.
Let's take a moment for poetry. This is from South Dakota poet Jim Reese. It's called "This Isn't Dress Rehearsal."
It's 53 degrees this afternoon. Tomorrow, time will spring ahead. In 5 minutes, the still obnoxiously loud grade school bell will alarm the neighborhood. In line at the chain link fence with some other fathers who have shown up, I'm waiting for you, my daughters. Today, recess should never end. In 2 months, one of you will leave this place for middle school, the other ascend to second grade. Some things never change. I claw my hands into the chain link that seems so much shorter now. I see the tire swing, the basketball hoop without a net, black top and worn tether ball. I'm not old enough to wish I were back in your shoes, not with the math homework you're assigned. But there's that aching for some of that freedom. Maybe that's why none of the fathers standing here say a word. And when I share the rough draft of this poem in class, a prisoner said, "That's one fence I never minded being behind." Girls, do you know how much I'm gonna miss these days? This magical moment on all our faces when we see each other between these boundaries, waiting to go home.
A poem from Jim Reese called "This Isn't Dress Rehearsal." Up next, live music from Aces and Eights. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Friday, and so we offer you another moment in sound. Today, we feature live music from Aces and Eights, classic country music. Harlan Allen and Kim Bachman are a traditional country music duo from the Black Hills. They received 2016 CD of the Year from two organizations, the National Traditional Country Music Association and the South Dakota Country Music Hall of Fame. Aces and Eights has just released The Heart of Country Music. You can join them at their CD release party on Saturday, February 25th. That's during Mardi Gras in Deadwood. But first, Aces and Eights joins us live from the SDPB studios in Rapid City. Welcome, Harland and Kim.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks for stopping by and tell me, you both have individual backgrounds as performers. How did you meet and become a duo?
Well, I don't know. It's been 2-3 years ago. At the time, Kim had an all-female group called the Phillies, and they opened a show for me at the Dahl Arts Center here in Rapid, and that's how we got to know each other. And then the Phillies had some bookings, and some of the members couldn't make it, so Kim asked me if I could fill in for some. And then suddenly the Phillies started to dissolve, and Kim and I were like, well, we kind of like what we're doing together, so let's put together a classic country duo. I guess that's kind of how it came about.
Is that the language that you used when did you say classic country?
Yes.
All right, tell me what that means exactly then to you.
Classic country to us is the roots of country music, and it is the music that you heard in the 60s and the 70s, and Johnny and June, Waylon, George Jones, Tammy Wynette. That's classic country to us.
Are there, Kim, certain foundational elements that you have to keep pure or authentic to have it fit that definition for you?
I think you do. I think that you have to strive to not over-engineer your songs and your CDs and keep it pure, as you said, and in that clean country sound.
Right. I have a Waylon Jennings record album that belonged to my dad that's on heavy rotation at my house right now, and I get that right away. That sound, you just don't hear it as much anymore. So maybe we can start out by playing something. Harlan, tell us what you're going to play first for us.
We're going to start with a song that I wrote. I wrote this for my granddaughter, and she stayed the night one night a couple of years ago. She wasn't quite a year old and wouldn't go to sleep, so I went in and sat down next to her and started playing some guitar and singing. And eventually she fell asleep, and about a week later I was out playing guitar on the front deck, and this song just started coming to me. And it's gotten some airtime in the UK. It's been played on a radio station there, and then it was the select song of the month in Iowa on a radio station for the month of October last year. So it's called Dear Child.
You are love. child, I'll be there. Oh, dear child, I will hold you and tell you how much you are loved. You are loved to the moon and the stars above. You are loved with an unconditional love. You are loved with eternal compassion and grace. You are loved. You are loved. You are loved.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Moment in Sound, SDPB Radio on In the Moment. Our guest, Aces and Eights, Kim Bachman and Harland Allen. Harland, am I saying your name correctly?
Yes,
Harland.
You are. All right. You got it right. You got it right. Most people do Allen Harland, but it's the other way around. So thank you.
So, Kim, I want to talk to you a little bit about growing up with music around the kitchen table, around the living room. I grew up with these record players and records playing nonstop, but you had live music right in your kitchen, right?
We sure did. On Saturday nights, the relatives would come over and gather around that kitchen table, and we'd break out the instruments and play all those good old country songs and just have such a good time. Kids were sitting on counters and on the floor, and grandma and grandpa around the table, uncles and aunts, and we sang loud and we sang proud, and not always on tune, but we sure enjoyed those old country songs.
That is just golden. Did you have an appreciation when you were maybe an adolescent that you had something that not every family has?
Yes, we sure did, and we knew that we were a little unique, a little redneck, maybe a little hillbilly gathering around on Saturday nights, and just loved every moment of it.
All right, let's hear another song. Kim, what's up next?
We are going to play a song that is written by Harland, was written by Harland, and it is about our local Deadwood, South Dakota, and the Wild Bill Hickok story.
Wonderful.
Called Aces and Eights, which is our namesake for our group, yes.
I was drinking beer and gambling down at number 10. Bill was there when he saw my cards. He said, "Son, you won this hand." I took the pot and bought a round, boy, did that feel great. Looking down at the two of each, aces and eights. Now we played cards late that night, and Bill was on a roll. He was winning dang near every hand, tearing at my soul. So I put in all I had. Bill sealed his fate when he won the hand with aces and eights. Aces and eights can be a winning hand. You may win a time or two, but you need to understand. Those two pair can mark your fate, so it's best to walk. Out the door, I knew someday I'd be back to settle up the score. sneaking in number 10's back door. Bill didn't know what hit him as he fell to the floor. I thought, what a twist of fate as I looked down at his cards. The last hand he ever held was aces and eights. Aces and eights is now the dead man's hand. You may win a time or two, but you need to understand. Those two pair mark Bill's fate, so it's best to walk away. If you're ever dealt the dead man's hand of aces and eights. Yeah, those two pair will change your fate, so it's best to walk away. If you're ever dealt the dead man's hand of aces and eights.
Our guests today, Aces and Eights, Kim Bachman, Harland Allen. They're broadcasting live from our studios in Rapid City. China Lockett is there with them. I'm Lori Walsh here at the University of Sioux Falls. Chris Loffrey, our producer, is down at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. We've got the whole state covered today, bringing you the music of Aces and Eights. And Harland, you've toured the whole state and the region. Talk about bringing this music and the power of a good story, too. To rural audiences.
Well, we our first CD, we did a CD release tour, and we were, I think, in five states and 28 different venues last summer and into fall. And it was, we love playing the venues that people are there to listen to the music and enjoy what we're doing. And we were blessed to have a lot of those venues last year that were, you know, about coming to see and listen to music. Yeah. So we had a really good tour last summer. Like I said, it kind of from most of the summer, from about May through, it wound up in Iowa in over Labor Day weekend, I think,
right.
It was.
So. Yes. Yeah.
All right, let's get one more song in, please. Tell me what you're going to play, Harland.
This is a song that I wrote, and I wrote it for my uncle Butch, and he is one of those that would gather around our table on Saturday nights and sing music with us, and he was always so full of zest, and I saw him last summer. I hadn't seen him in a while, and he was kind of down in the dumps, and he felt like he was aging and kind of losing a little bit of hope, and it bothered me so much because he was always so zestful, and I went home and I wrote this song for him. And for anyone who needs a little hope in their life, it's called My Best Years. Whisper bright colors and
with your annual support.